It's been 4 weeks since Easter Sunday. And do you know what happened to the disciples after that first Easter? What did they do? Can't hear you. Someone said something, I didn't hear it. Yeah, they left. And they weren't quite sure what to do at first, I think. They were locked up in a room together for a while, remember? They were afraid. They were afraid to believe even when they saw Jesus. Resurrection is unbelievable. It's incredible. Well, this bunch went home, as Kyung said. Seven of them are back on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. They're back where they started, where it all started, their old stomping grounds. They had followed Jesus for 3 years. They heard his teachings. They saw him heal people. They even saw him raise Lazarus from the dead. And they followed him into Jerusalem. They saw him tried and tortured, and they watched as he was crucified. And then when they thought it was all finished, that it was all lost, they saw the empty tomb. And they saw the risen Christ in person with their own eyes. And then, they didn't live happily ever after. They didn't go out boldly proclaiming the resurrection. They went home because they still weren't quite sure what to do with themselves. What difference does resurrection make? Has it changed anything? Has your life changed since you got the news? When you had your own Easter, when you discovered the living Christ in your own life, did it change your life? Or did you just go on with the same old routine? Well, it's what the disciples did, at least at first. They went back to the beach, back to their old stomping grounds. But obviously, they weren't quite sure what to do with themselves because they're all sitting around the beach together, kind of at loose ends. And finally, Peter says, I'm going to go fishing. What else am I going to do? He was a fisherman. And the others decided to join him. And as we've heard, they didn't catch a thing. Now, we got to stop here. These guys have been fishing since they were little. How could they not catch anything all night? There's a clue. Did anybody catch? We'll find out who the really detail-oriented people are. Did anybody catch where they were? The name of the place where they were? I hear murmuring. Where were they? The Sea of what? Galilee. The Sea of Galilee, eh? Are you sure?
In the Bible reading, it said Sea of Tiberias.
Aha! Bev remembers. I said Galilee a minute ago. It's true. And that is what it was called. But in the scripture reading, it says the Sea of Tiberias. Now, which is it? Well, it's the same place. But by then, its official name was the Sea of Tiberias. You see, during Jesus' lifetime, during the disciples' lifetime, the Sea of Galilee was officially renamed by Herod, the king of Israel, who is sucking up to the Roman governor, Roman emperor. So he names it after Caesar, Emperor Tiberius. The same Caesar that was in power when Jesus was crucified. Their home territory, the lake, the sea where they grew up, has been renamed after the emperor who killed Jesus. Ay, ay, ay. And by the time that this gospel, the Gospel of John, is written, it's a few generations later, a new city had been built on that lake, on the Sea of Tiberias. They had built a brand new city called Tiberias. Herod had built it. A new Roman city that had become a fishing port. An industrial fishery had been established on that lake, and that lake was claimed by Emperor Tiberius and taxed. If you wanted to go out on the lake to fish, you paid a tax. If you caught any fish, you were taxed on every fish. And the traditional fishery in Galilee was decimated during the lifetime of the disciples and in the first few generations after Jesus. They could fish, but they had to pay tax every time they went out, and then for every fish they caught. It wasn't their Sea of Galilee anymore, it was the Sea of Tiberias. And that industrial fishery sent all the big, juicy fish to Rome. Wasn't for the people anymore. The disciples hadn't just returned to the idyllic world of their pre-Jesus life. They had returned to the shores of the Sea of Despair. They are in despair and they don't know what's going on. They've seen Jesus, but then Jesus is gone. They see Jesus again, and then he's gone. And meanwhile, Rome is starting to make war on Israel because the people just won't knuckle under. And by the time John has written the gospel, there has been a 50-year war, destroying every significant city in Israel. Jerusalem, Nazareth, all of them. But not Tiberias. Tiberias carries on supplying wonderful fish from the Sea of Tiberias for Rome. As dawn breaks, the fishers find themselves floating aimlessly just off the shore. They haven't caught anything. They don't know what's happening to their lives. Hey, lads, have you caught anything? No, they answer. Who's that? Well, drop the net on the right side. You'll find some there. Right. I don't know why they did it. One of the theories I shared with you earlier, that maybe you could, from the shore, you know, depending on your angle, could catch sight of where there might be some fish. Possible. But they did it. There's something to that. They weren't even sure what they were doing, but they did it. And wow, what a catch. The net was overflowing, and pretty much too heavy to haul back in the boat. They had to kind of drag it behind the boat, maybe. And then when one of them got a closer look, is that Jesus? Peter's reaction was instantaneous. His usual impetuous self, he let go of the net, leaving the rest of them to worry about it. He grabbed his shirt because they probably, you know, got down to near nakedness to do their work. And he ran ashore to see Jesus. Jesus had started a fire. Peter's there and says, well, why don't you bring some of that fish? I wonder what tone of voice it was. You know, it's like, have you forgotten your buddies who are dragging the fish? Go help them and bring some of that fish. Join me for breakfast, he says. It was a strangely familiar invitation, especially when he started handing out the fish and the bread. Does that ring any bells for anyone? What do you think they remembered when Jesus started handing out fish and bread? Any ideas? Go ahead, Bev. When they fed all those people with a little bit of fish and bread, of course. Sounds familiar, right? Any other time when Jesus was handing out bread? Maybe the Last Supper, eh? And of course, that whole scene is completely reminiscent of the very first one, which is why I tried to kind of tell those two fish stories together today. They're right back where they started. And the way this story is told several generations after Jesus has as much to do with what's going on at that time when they're telling the story as what was going on when the story happened. It's important. What was going on with the fishery in Galilee was important. The war, the decimation of Israel are all part of the backdrop of how this story is told. Jesus invites them to a feast. Not just any old breakfast, way better than the smoothie I had this morning. A good, big, robust fisherman's breakfast. Like the diner, you know, you have the trucker's plate. Well, this was a fisherman's plate. And they probably remembered the Last Supper and that time when he fed all those people. And they eat that big fish that's generally meant for someone else's plate. For people like Herod and Pilate and Caesar. That was their breakfast, that they were literally taking food from the plate, from the table of Caesar. Jesus didn't say, you know, sell it and give the money to the poor. He said, let's eat. If you had been that one of those disciples sitting on that beach with Jesus, you would have understood that Jesus was not just giving them breakfast. Jesus was not just showing up to prove that he had risen from the dead. Jesus was inviting them to a very different kind of imperial feast. This was Jesus' imperial feast, where the poor sit down together with their loving Lord, and where they eat food that might have been meant for kings and emperors. This is the future that Jesus came to remind them about again. This is the kingdom, and this is what it will be like forever. Of course, there's a part two or three to this story, depending on how you count it. Peter, the whole conversation with Peter. Peter, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Feed my lambs, said Jesus. Again he asks him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Jesus' answer was a little less sheepish, or Peter's answer was a little less sheepish this time. Lord, you know everything. You know I love you. Again, feed my sheep. And then a third time, right? Why does Jesus ask him three times? Does he not believe him? Or are we thinking back to something else that happened three times? Right? That woman by the fire the night Jesus was arrested. Hey, you're a Galilean too, right? You're with Jesus, aren't you? Woman, I don't know the man. Three times he did that. To his utter shame. After promising Jesus he would be with him through thick and thin. When push came to shove and he was threatened with the same fate as Jesus, Peter did not come through. And so Jesus sees Peter and asks him, do you love me more than these? And it might have made Peter sad, and it might have exposed the shame that he was already feeling. But maybe this was Peter's chance to change his testimony, to change his denials of even knowing Jesus into promises that he still loves him. We have all denied Christ too, by our actions, our words, our lack of words. How often do we feel shame and guilt and unworthiness that we're just not good enough, we're not enough? In so many different ways, in so many parts of our lives, we feel inadequate. Jesus not only tells Peter that he is still his guy, he shows him. And in asking him three times, Jesus erases the three denials and restores Peter not only to discipleship, but to leadership. Just like Peter, we have a chance to change our testimony and declare our love for Christ. Nothing that we ever do can ever disqualify us from Jesus' love. Nothing can ever cut us off from God's love and acceptance, or from our call to serve God by serving others, by caring for others, by feeding God's sheep. Not only are we accepted like Peter, we are called out like Peter. Called out this time in a good way. So one of the questions for each of us today is, what do we say? If Jesus were to single you out and ask you personally, do you love me more than these? What would you say? Well, wait a minute. What are these anyway? Do you love me more than these? What's he talking about? Maybe we all have different these's. When Jesus asks you if you love him more than these, what are the things that you might love more than Jesus? For me, there's all kinds of things. Do I love Jesus more than my position, my ministry, being a minister? Do I love Jesus more than my family? Do I love Jesus more than my new electric car? New to me. Or my money, or my computer. My wife would say, yeah, your computer. Or my TV, or our house. Do I really love Jesus more than these? When the question is that personal, what is your answer? Jesus invited the disciples to disregard the emperor and his tax and join the feast of God's kingdom. There, beside the sea of despair, he invited them to a feast. So in the midst of all of our despair about COVID, about climate change, about Ukraine, about systemic racism, about now the potential return of the criminalization of reproductive rights, in the U.S. at least, and so many other things that might fill us with despair, that do fill us with despair, leaving us confused and sad, Jesus invites us to set a table beside that sea of despair and feast on the abundance of God's blessings. We aren't called to ignore or deny all the challenges and pain in our world and in our lives, but we are called to set a table beside the sea of despair and invite people to a new feast. We will set the table at the edge of despair. We'll sing songs all day long. We'll feast on God, our lover and our friend, and the feast goes on and on. Oh, welcome the day to this wondrous feast, the feast that will never end. Welcome this day to the wondrous feast. Welcome, fishers and friends. Amen.